train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealer's honking. Don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord.
Street of Fish, real talk.
All right, y'all, so we're back. It's the iTunes Street Official Real Talk Podcast. We're having a special presentation of Black History Month where I'm bringing on, you know, some of the folks that I think can actually give you guys a huge background into our equity and value as people from the past all the way up to the present. And today, I got to tell you, I'm honored to have not only a civil rights leader, I'm going to say world leader, and as well, you know, was almost your president at one time. I'm going to let him introduce himself. Why don't you go ahead and speak up?
Reverend Jesse Jackson, Rainbow Push Coalition, how are you?
All right, Reverend. So the first thing I want to do is I want to get into the Rainbow Push Coalition. And I would like for you, if you could, please give us an idea of the history of the Rainbow Push Coalition, what you've been able to achieve with this organization.
Rainbow Push Coalition is a progressive civil rights organization. It is our mission to defend, protect, and gain civil rights. I worked with Dr. King from 1965 to Skilling in 1968, and in 1971 we formed Operation Push. We worked in breadbasket before that time, using our consumer strength as economic leverage to open up closed doors, and we expanded in 1971. I ran for the president in 1984, but I wanted to have a broad-based, multiracial coalition of blacks, Hispanics, Asians, Native Americans, Jewish Americans, Arab Americans. We call ourselves the Rainbow, representing the peoples of the earth. And so we ran an 84 and 88 campaign. So then we really merged Push and Rainbow, and so now it's the Rainbow Push Coalition. And we fight for racial justice and gender equality, workers' rights, the rights of children, and for world peace.
You know, Reverend Jackson, sometimes, you know, black leaders have been stereotyped as folks who would only fight for black causes. But, you know, looking at your track record, you know, your history says you fight for people across the board around the world. How do you feel about that?
God has given me a good long run of it. And I was jailed July 16, 1960, trying to use a public library. And we kept fighting for decency in law and for equal protection under the law. And then I was North Carolina A&T State University. We kept marching in the sit-ins and working with CORE and NAACP youth chapter. And then began to work with Dr. King in 1965. And so I've been on this battlefield for a long time. And we always reached out, but that was not always receptive hands. I mean, Dr. King reached out, but they chopped off his fingers. He reached out because we believed always that we had to form a base between which no one would fall. For example, most poor people in America are not black. They're white, they're female, they're young. But whether white, black, or brown, hunger hurts. When they close a plant gate and take jobs to cheap labor markets abroad, they turn the lights out. We all look amazingly similar in the dark. We seek to build relationships, what I call moving from racial battleground to economic common ground and on to moral higher ground. But all three of those realms are important. Racial justice, shared moral values, as well as our quest for coexistence.
And Reverend, I want to ask you this. You know, when you think back, you know, into the height of the civil rights movement, you know, there was the NAACP, which actually took the forefront. Where do things differ with Rainbow Push? I mean, in terms of the agenda, maybe the agenda is the same and it's just maybe a different approach. I'm not sure.
We're part of that lineage. The civil rights movement it's not over. This notion by back in the day, the civil rights struggle has not changed. It changes forms. I mean, 246 years of legal slavery. That was a civil rights struggle to abolish it. And by the 13th Amendment, it was abolished. And that was, then the promise was broken in 1877 with the Compromise. In 1896, they recodified segregation. The struggle continued. NAA was born almost 100 years ago, fighting for racial justice and women's rights and workers' rights and peace and changing the legal system, as happened in 1954 with a new legal frame of reference. And then, of course, Luther King emergence in 1955, the Montgomery bus boycott and sit-ins in 1960, student sit-ins, the right to vote in 1965, which changed everything, really. And out of that, among other things, Dick Hatcher became mayor of Gary and Carl Stokes of Cleveland. Those were great breakthroughs at that time, and Bradley in L.A., and then the big breakthrough of Harold Washington, 83 in Chicago, and in 84 and 88, I campaigned to emerge for the presidency, and then, of course, Doug Wiley became governor of Virginia, and Carmel DeBrun became a senator from Illinois, and later on, of course, Barack Obama in the season of 2007 and 8. So there's been an unbroken line of struggle to even the playing field, to make the rules public, and to make this a more perfect union.
And Reverend, you know, I'm glad you said that. I'm one of those people that do not believe that. I believe there's been some change and some progress. At the same time, I believe there's still a long way to go. However, the younger, I would say, the guys I speak to that are still in their 20s don't see things the same way I may see things. And I'm wondering if you could, in some way, let us understand what happened during the civil rights era that still plagues us today in terms of what we deal with. And I understand there's certain things that we don't have to see that maybe your generation did.
Look at what did happen. Let's look at the unfinished business. And even a young generation must either learn by reading or by conversation what happened before them. Life did not start the day you were born. You have some obligation to know what landmarks that guided you to where you are today. You're the result of a process of development. And so from 1896 to 1954, we were living in a legal Jim Crow. Rosa Parks was arrested for going to sit in the front of the bus. The bus driver was right legally.
Mm-hmm.
She was right morally. And she took the hit of going to jail, and ultimately what was morally right challenged the unjust legal laws. You know, it was a struggle. I mean, the day that Dr. King gave the speech in Washington, 1963, August 20th, what we see on TV is I have a dream. What you don't see is that from Texas across to Florida up to Maryland, we couldn't use a single public toilet. My high school senior class couldn't take a picture on the lawn of the state capitol in Columbia, South Carolina. When we came to Washington in August of 63, our money was counterfeited. We could not buy ice cream at Howard Johnson's.
Mm.
We couldn't rent a room at Holiday Inn or the Hilton. We couldn't buy a hamburger at a restaurant. We couldn't use the toilets at the roadside inns along the South. And so during that period, you had citizens who were of means who couldn't use a toilet. You had veterans of foreign wars who had to pay taxes and had medals on their chest but could not vote. So we had to overcome the laws of Jim Crow. And that 55 to 64 period helped to bring down those barriers under Dr. King's leadership. In 65, the right to vote. It's hard to imagine now, but we, by the millions, could not register and vote, although we had to pay taxes, and that was a great battle. That battle inspired freedom movements throughout Africa. There's a connection between our right to vote and African independence, between Dr. King going to jail in 63 and Mandela going in 63, except Dr. King got out earlier. Our right to vote gave us the power to challenge our Congress to pass a sanctions to help free Mandela in South Africa. So our freedom literally changed the world. And so young America must be connected to the rhythm of our struggle. You have a need to know from whence you come. You have a need to know the road that you were born on to and where it came from and where that road is going. And so today we have public accommodations, a protected right. We have the right to vote. But Dr. King said in the first chapter of his book, and where do we go from here, is we've won the non-cost freedom items. It doesn't cost any more to allow us to use a library or to allow us to use a hotel, a motel, or use public facilities. Those are cost-free freedoms. But now we need to focus on closing the divide, and that will require investment. To have a fair share of education and health care and housing and job training will require investment. Today we don't have a problem with race or the problem with racial disparity. People of color work harder and make less, pay more for less, live under stress, and don't live as long.
Mm-hmm.
Then we need investment to close the gap. They just had a big debate in South Carolina, the voting of the campaign this year, the Republicans and the Democrats, and then saw Hillary and Barack and Edwards debating. And I thought the media missed a big moment, but not the stealing of the foot is the unfinished business of the South. And that unfinished business is evening the playing field. On the ball fields, when South Carolina plays Clemson, it's such a beautiful day. The Gamecocks playing the Tigers, and they are beyond race because the playing field is even.
Right.
And the rules are public and the goals are clear. But beyond the playing field, the infant mortality, black infant mortality rate is higher, and life expectancy is shorter. Blacks have less access to colleges and universities beyond the ball field or the ball court. The home foreclosure crisis, about 54% of all blacks got subprime loans. Half of them were eligible for prime loans. About 47% of Latinos who got subprime loans, many were eligible for prime loans. 18% white. And so you see that black people are means paying more for less because of steering and predator exploitation. So we still are paying more for less. This whole global economic crisis is driven by not honoring civil rights laws of open housing and fair lending laws. And so it becomes our challenge now to fight for equal protection for all citizens, to fight for an even playing field for all Americans, and in that way we'll go forward. So we want to now fight for prenatal care for all Americans, Head Start and daycare on the front side, rather than jail care and welfare on the backside. Let's make this a more perfect union.
Real talk. Real talk.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah.
Real talk.
Yes, my skin is black, but that's no reason to hold me back.
One of the things I wanted to, you know, also say, you know, in regards to the foreclosure issues that you're speaking about, you know, when I was in college, I ended up taking a class, Racism in America. One day this a military higher up retiree had actually came into the classroom, and he mentioned that, you know, one of the things that happened when they built those highways here in the United States is that one of the strategies was to push black people up against the water. Because, you know, segregation was high in case there was ever to be race riots or whatever else. And now that I've gotten older, in the beginning, I didn't understand what he meant. Now that I'm older and I'm looking at places like where Hurricane Katrina hit, if you go up along the West Coast, if you go into New York, you look up against the water and you find that's where, you know, poor people have been placed. Now, all of a sudden, because of all the integration and so on. And that waterfront property, that property is now worth a lot of money, but you got to get the people out of it. So Katrina, just, you know, I'm going to that for a reason. You know, the day that a few days after it happened, I said to a friend of mine, that's going to be a developer's dream. Unfortunately, the people are going to suffer. They're going to run these people out of here and take over that waterfront. And you can see changes happening in different cities, whether it be in Oakland, whether it be, you know, somewhere back east. And I just want to get your opinion on that, because they are railroading people out of these places for malls, for other housing development, for the rich to actually have, you know, beachfront property,
et cetera. It's called gentrification.
Yes, sir.
It's like many years ago, they put the Native Americans in desolate places like Oklahoma and Texas. When they discovered oil, they put them off on the reservations.
Mm-hmm.
Many of these inner cities were built on where blacks lived, but very valuable property with access to waterways, railway, and airports and downtown America. Now you see a concerted move to abandon affordable housing in these cities and replenish them with unaffordable condos. And the economic gentrification process, of course, is further cramping the housing crisis that we have today. I'm so concerned about the subprime housing project. Blacks have lost in 8 years almost $275 billion in home equity value.
Wow.
And it is obvious, I just met with the FDIC leadership, that we see that blacks, I tell you, and Latinos with eligible for prime loans were steered racially in the subprime. When they paid more for less, now they cannot pay the adjustable rate. They're going from a house that costs too much, not to foreclosures, evictions, and auctions. I'm urging the government to, in fact, stop the foreclosures, restructure loans, and not repossess homes. That's what we're marching today in Washington at the Housing and Urban Development, saying, do not put people out of their houses, restructure loans, and don't repossess homes. And one of our witnesses was a soldier, Major Allen, on his third tour of Iraq, about to go back to Iraq. His mom and daddy, who built the house 29 years ago, facing eviction. We're fighting to save their house. I mean, he is the face of foreclosures. 24 years in the military, been to Iraq twice, going to Iraq the third time, and they're taking his family's house. We're going to fight to save his house.
And Reverend, I got to ask you this. You know, I've seen a lot of your causes that you fought for. And how offended are you when you hear, you know, people make remarks about, you know, black leaders trying to extort and trying to do different things? Because I have to say, if people like you don't fight for other people's rights, they'll just get mowed over. If there isn't a grouping or leadership that says we have to stand up and even make us aware, because a lot of us are asleep, we're thinking about the Super Bowl and new telephones and girlfriends and whatever else, and we're not paying attention to the details that are going to affect us.
Well, that's the price that leadership has to pay. You know, it's Noah with a message from God that's going to rain. For many years, he was ignored. He had to keep saying, however, it's going to rain. Even though you don't see a cloud in the sky, it's going to rain. One day, it did begin to rain. The rain didn't stop. And those inside the ark who could not swim survived. They organized a structure. Those outside who could swim drowned because they could not survive 40 days and 40 nights without stopping. And so sometimes you are a lonesome voice. You are Noah saying it's going to rain. You are John the Baptist saying a greater one is coming. Just hold on. You often are that voice saying, let's stand up and fight back because it's our moral obligation to do so. So leadership must be, in fact, long-distance runners.
During the days of Jim Crow, and you told us all the things you couldn't do, and, you know, I'm not going to even ask you to give us the idea of what happens when you do it. I mean, it's not like seeing a sign that says speed limit 65 and you do 70 and get pulled over and get a ticket. You know, there's greater consequences to making choices to go against Jim Crow in groups. But to tie this into what's going on now, in regards to real estate, You know, Jim Crow also played a huge part in where we could and could not purchase, if we could and could not purchase. And that all plays into our economics, which I had an argument with a friend of mine in saying that the level, the playing field's not leveled because we've got generations of people who have been cheated, which means that, you know, and I'll give you an example. My home, the equity in my home potentially is my son's scholarship money, if it gets down to that. If I don't have a savings sitting aside, it may be the money that I need to actually create other opportunities for generations to come from my family. But if you take that all away from me or never give me the opportunity to have the same opportunity as Jimmy Joe next door, his kids may go away to college. And again, being accepted into college going 50 years ago where, you know, our folks could not go to those same schools.
But you raised two different questions. One of them is that on the subprime, subversive economics, if your neighbor's home is in foreclosure, your home loses value.
That's right.
And so we're bound together. And if, in fact, we are targeted by race to get a higher price loan and put us in jeopardy, that is Jim Crow Esquire. That's Jim Crow Escarita. Those are Jim Crow's children. They've gone from redlining by denying us money, redlining by giving us money on unfair and expensive conditions. That's just Jim Crow with a ribbon wrapped around it. So you look at the subprime crisis, we see heavy evidence. You take, for example, Prince George's County, the largest black middle-class community in America, all these government workers from Washington right across the border. There are 14,000 home foreclosures. Of the 50,000 subprime loans. It has affected 300,000 homes, dividing them by at least 5,000 per home. The loss of tax and value of these houses is $2.8 billion. That's the size of the budget of the county. The loss of revenue from home devaluation, the last 8 years on blacks has been $250 billion, largest transfer of wealth in the history of this nation. And so Jim Crow has come back with a vengeance. He's smarter, slicker, smoother, and his sons and daughters are much more skilled, but the reality is you see patterns of race violation. And when the law is not enforced, they run amok. That's why there's a desire this year among men to get beyond race. We're beyond race. We're not beyond the need for racial justice. And when you do have the law applied, we all do well on the football field and the basketball court. The law has not been applied in housing, health care, access to education. You take South Carolina, for example, where they held the debate. That state's 35% African American, right?
Right.
Prison's about 75% black. Last 6 years, blacks have been 110,000 arrested a year over the last 6 years. 110,000 calls to lawyers, to bailiffs, and the court appearances. There are 34 state prisons, majority black. One state college, South Carolina State College. I mean, the largest single industry in that state is the jail and industrial complex for profit. So, race is not the problem. Race disparity is the problem. Race exploitation is the problem. And here you have the biggest industry in the state, the making of prisons, building of prisons, supplying prisons with products, prisons working, prison labor, is essentially by blacks. And that is simply unacceptable. We have an obligation to cry. We cannot be deceived beyond that reality.
And Reverend, would you say now, you know, and let's speak about that particular, that industry. Would you say now that there's even a movement to continue to lock people up for workforce, for cheap labor?
Well, there's no doubt about that. There are 2.2 million Americans in jail today, 1 million are black, 900,000 are black men.
That's right.
And that's connected to, in every major city, 7 of 10 young black men don't finish high school. That's a pipeline from school or street to jail. Flip it another way. In Illinois, 70% of all drug users are white, 11% are black. In jail, 66% black, 11% are white. And those who have money and a lawyer and get rehab, they go to college. Those who don't have money go to jail. That's the pattern. And so we have some need to deal with end funding disparity in our schools, to end disparity in the criminal justice system. The struggle for equal justice is not over. That struggle continues. And there are those who have us think that we're beyond race. Well, there are some places where we are. When the Giants play New England on that afternoon, you cannot choose a team based upon race. And you'll choose the Patriots or the Giants, because on that field you've got blacks and whites on both sides. There's 10 yards for all first downs, 6 yards for all touchdowns. Even playing field, rules public, goals clear. The winner will win, the loser will lose, and they will embrace because they will have had a fair chance to win. And because of that, you can accept winning and or losing. Beyond the ball field, that's not reality. That is America's unfinished business. That's Dr. King's unfinished business. That is America's great moral dilemma and its challenge.
Real talk, real talk.
Oh, what's happening, CC? They still call it the White House, but that's a temporary condition, too. Can you dig it, CC? To each his reach, and if I don't cop, it ain't mine to have. But I'll be reaching for you, because I love you, CC. Right on. There's a lot of chocolate cities around. We've got Newark, we've got Gary. Somebody told me we got L.A. And we're working on Atlanta. You're the capital.
Daddy loves you.
Get down.
Daddy loves
you. Moving in on.
Daddy loves you.
Real talk. Real talk. Real talk.
Brown skin. You know I love your brown skin. I can't tell where yours begins. I can't tell where mine. Brown skin up against my brown skin. Need some every now and then. No.
Real talk. Real talk.
When you take a look, do you think we as people are on the right path to living up to Dr. King's dream?
Well, some people are doing a better job at it than others against the odds. I mean, when you look up, on the one hand, you see Tiger Woods on the golf course, we are excited. But that's one guy. Most young blacks with golf playing ability cannot afford to get golf clubs and go to links. You look at Oprah on TV, an outstanding artist. But that's just one person. You look at the BET breakthrough, Bob and Sheila Johnson. But that's just two people. You look at our athletes who are, you take in the basketball season, what they call them, like March Madness.
Mm-hmm.
And 6-14, 32-16, 8-4, and then 2. It's about 90% black ball players, right?
Right.
But the graduation time, look at the contrast. March Madness,
yes, sir.
Ball playing, May Madness for graduation. All these bowl teams, very black and very white, and that's a good thing. But look in the classrooms. You don't have the same amount of scholarships for classrooms that you do for ball players. So the struggle for fairness continues.
And Reverend, do you find that there's a struggle for appreciation from, you know, say, the generations after yours, you know, and in particular, young black men and their roles and what they should or maybe could or maybe what they are doing? I'm saying in your eyes, are young black folks living up to their full potential as they should?
Well, they're not. You know, I oftentimes, when I grew up, we were not free and knew it. There are many young blacks who are not free and don't know it. Therefore, they let their guard down. You cannot afford to let your guard down. You cannot afford in your quest for dignity do less than your best. You can't not go to school. You can't go and not study. You cannot self-destruct through drugs and liquor. You cannot make babies that you don't raise. You cannot set the grade calling yourself names and calling your women names, we're not that free. And if we were, we should use our freedom for higher purposes. We should upgrade, not downgrade. We should embrace, not reject. We should love and not hate. We should choose life over death and futures over funerals. I mean, we have an obligation to have a higher sense of values. And so we must accept the responsibility. Do it all. If you're behind, run faster. If you're down, get up. Because no one will pick you up. But when you fall down, the ground is no place for a champion. Get back up again and run faster. That's the story of our race. We are dream makers and odds busters. Dream the big dream. Bust your odds and make it anyhow. But don't walk around as if you are freer than you are, but you're exposing your body in the public, you know, with a certain kind of a disposition that's not healthy. I ask many of our young people who walk around with their pants exposed and their buttocks, like, what Italian designer designed that? I mean, where'd that come from? Let me think. I said, let me tell you, no one designed it. In jail, you don't wear tailor-made pants, you can't wear a belt. You may hang somebody, you may be hung. Or you cannot wear strings in your shoes. So in the jail, all you have your shoes on without strings, you have your pants hanging off your butt, and it's all male dormitory, so to speak.
Right.
And they have turned that jail culture into black culture. That's not the natural, that's norm. We must reject subnorm and fight for that which is natural. Our nature's above our normality. Am I making sense to you?
Yes, sir.
I mean, men walk around without dignity is not natural. It's normal, but we must move to a higher, that's subnormal. We have an obligation to move to a higher norm, create our own norm. When our athletes become the best in the world, because they train so hard. I mean, these guys on that ball field on Sunday afternoons, I mean, they are train freaks. They work hard. They run. They lift. They push. They drive. They excel. They're not good because they look at it. They're good because they work at it. And that same effort will make us chemists, physicists, scientists, as we are ball players, singers, and dancers.
And, you know, I wanted to ask you about this, too, something that's going on currently, you know, and I'll tie this into blaxploitation films, you know, back in the 70s. You know, and for a long time, you know, it's always been noted that blaxploitation pretty much saved Hollywood when it was going through bankruptcy. I mean, there were a lot of companies on the edge of folding, and they found a way to have a cheap art form that they could make, you know, you spend a dime and you make $10 on it. And I want to ask you, in your opinion, do you see hip hop as almost not only being somewhat similar as blaxploitation, but also because of the way that contractually things are set up and the way the outcome for the artist, that it's almost like a sharecropping system?
Well, I tell you, I see hip hop bottoming out now. There is a new emerging consciousness about we should not sell records for the purpose of making money without values. I was at an affair about 3 years ago, and once I got to speaking at the banquet, the people began to dance and drink, and they were dancing to the tune of Nigga by one of the artists. It was so humiliating and so embarrassing. I think more and more artists now realize just how detrimental and how damaging that is, and we encourage them to go to higher ground. I also noticed that many of the artists, Jay-Z and others, have a great sense of entrepreneurship, beginning to market their own product beyond singing and dancing. They are now building businesses, and that is the healthiest thing I see coming out of hip-hop culture, using their talents and skills to be manufacturers and salespeople and producers and marketers, not just singing. And when they do sing, songs of uplift. I mean, Stevie Wonder singing Blowing in the Wind. I remember for 10 years we tried to get the Dr. King holiday.
Right.
And we marched in the cold January 15th with some very cold days. And we really couldn't arouse people on the King holiday. And Stevie Wonder did Happy Birthday, Martin Luther King. That song by an artist, took us to the next level. That's what art really can do, can take us to the next level. I remember as a kid growing up that we would hear Harry Belafonte sing songs about the Caribbean. At that time, the Caribbean was like a foreign country. It was not like, you know, next door, that you can fly the way we can fly. But Harry Belafonte used the stage in his songs to lift up our culture and take us to the next level. And every generation of artists have that moral obligation to use their art to lift up and not to tear down and not to self-destruct.
And you know, Reverend, when I had a conversation with KRS-One, one of the things I mentioned to him is that, you know, this question comes up quite a bit when I'm, you know, watching some of the town hall meetings and some of the conferences on TV1 and BET. And the question becomes, what happened to our black leadership? And I stand to say our black leadership could have voices, but the men have to stand up and want to take it. The fans of hip hop alone, I'm not going to even get into any other genre, the athletes or whatever else. If hip hop alone already tell you, if you selling 2 and 3 million albums, that you've got potentially probably 10 times that amount of an audience that will listen to what it is that you have to say. The choice becomes what it is that you're willing to say.
Well, you must have values where you will not make money at any cost. You cannot sell out your values just for money. But, you know, we are more leaders than ever before. That's optical. You know, we had 400 black elected and appointed officials in 1965 in Selma. Now we have over 10,000. I mean, leaders are mayors of Newark and Washington, Atlanta, New Orleans. I mean, leaders are 43 blacks in the Congress. Leaders are state legislators. They're city council members. The Board of Education members and presidents. They are county officials. They are young, very able, trained ministers. They are labor leaders. Our leadership base is broader than ever before. We've never had as many leaders before at every level as we do today. To say we don't have them is just, again, it's a distortion of reality.
What do you think of the 2008 election in terms of having a woman, you have African-American, you have a slant that's looking like it potentially will go Democratic after, you know, 8 years of whatever we've had before? I just want to get your overall summary of what you think is going on for 2008.
Let me say, we won in 2000. Gore got the most votes. The election was stolen. We won then.
Yes, sir.
I voted in 92 and 96. Bush and Dole got more white votes than Clinton. He got more white, black, and brown, and he won in 92 and 96. The Republicans decided they could not win by registration. They decided to win by nullification. They nullified votes in Florida and in Ohio. So we should not give up. We won those battles. Then we got to keep on fighting. There's something unique about 2008 in the sense that I was looking at the debate in New Hampshire. That was Bill Richardson, an Hispanic. It was a progressive white from South Carolina. Barack, an African-American, and Hillary Clinton, a woman. To see them in that frame debating the great issues of our time, foreign and domestic policy, in New Hampshire, that's a huge breakthrough. When I was there in 84 and 88, I was there alone. But now you've got women, blacks, Hispanics, progressive whites from the South. That is a sea change in our lifetime. And so this campaign has been made even more exciting because of the impact of Barack Obama and Hillary. I think Barack, Hillary, and Edwards represent a real opportunity. If they can keep on the issues and off of each other, keep expanding registration, and keep fighting for issues that matter, and avoid what I call the sucker punches. You know, in South Carolina, 62% of all people who work don't have health insurance. Focus on that. Mm-hmm. The jail industrial complex is the number one industry in the state. Focus on more schools and fewer jails. Focus on that. It's the number one toxic waste dump. Clean it up. Focus on that. End the war in Iraq. Begin to reinvest in America and rebuild America, not tear down other countries. Focus on that. They keep focusing on issues that matter. They will win. One of them will win. Will deserve to win. To be sure, we have been very impressed with Barack's candidacy this year. I think it takes our struggle to another level. And the fact that there's a broad-based coalition inspires all of us.
What does Black History Month mean to you?
A chance to study the history and in long terms. I mean, 1619 to 1863, 244 years, know that period. Emancipation Proclamation, January 1st, 1863. For many years, that was not a day just to eat greens and ham hocks and watch ball games. That was Emancipation Day. It was incomplete without the 13th Amendment in 1865. We ended 246 years of slavery. I mean, study that. Then the Compromise of 1877. In 1896, Jim Crow laws made constitutional. Then we ended in 54. My point is, use this month to study our history and how, against all odds, strong men and strong women kept on coming. And so I say, through it all, strong minds break strong chains. Learn, live, share, grow, and give. And in this quest for dignity and freedom, let no lies deter you. Let no graveyard contain you. And through it all, keep hope alive.
Real talk. Real.
Like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Real talk. Real talk.
This is Reverend Jesse Jackson, Rainbow Push Coalition. You're listening to Real Talk. Keep hope alive.